He's John. I'm Mark. This is the Enthusiastic Cast, the web show where we talk about books that we're really excited about. This week, I am enthusiastic about J.G. Ballard's High Rise. But first, Happy New Year to everybody. It's been holiday lazy time here at the Enthusiastic HQ, and that means one thing. That means that we go to a lot of movies. And so we've gone to the same movies independently of one another, which is always a nice treat. So I guess we're going to talk about it. So, John, I have no idea if you are a Westerns fan or not, but I know you're a genre guy, right? And so in the evolution of the Western genre, you have kind of point, you have counterpoint, and then you have Clint Eastwood's The Unforgiven. And we have both seen the Coen Brothers' True Grit at separate times in separate theaters in separate locations. And what does the Coen Brothers' True Grit have to say that's new in light of the fact that you can never make another Western after Clint Eastwood did? Oh, and it doesn't matter. And will we be hearing about this movie at Oscar time, or should I have gone to see Black Swan instead?
That's a lot of questions. So
I've got one more for you later.
All right. I don't think it has anything new to say about Westerns, really. But I definitely think you'll be hearing about it come Oscar time. I think you should have gone to see Black Swan as well, but not instead of this movie. They're, you know, a different piece. And, I mean, I'm a Westerns fan in the same way that I'm a zombie fan, just kind of accidentally. I think because you can't make Westerns anymore, those Westerns that do get made are actually really good, right? If you look at, you know, The Unforgiven, The Quick and the Dead from Sam Raimi, 310 to Yuma, the remake was really good. You don't get crap Westerns, really, which is kind of cool and kind of awesome. And I'm a big Coen Brothers fan, and I'm really excited about this film because it may redeem me for 20 years ago recommending that my parents see Barton Fink, and that basically just submarine. I mean, I still love that movie. It's a fantastic movie, but it submarined my cred with them, and I feel like this is going to be my comeuppance or their comeuppance, because I watched this movie and I kind of feel like it's a multi-generational movie, and it's the most accessible film the Coens have ever made, bar none. And that's why it is, you know, now their most profitable film to date. And it just jumped into the top five for the most profitable Westerns of all time, and is probably going to end up in the number two spot behind Dances with Wolves. So this is a huge, huge mega hit for them. And I think that alone is why you're going to hear about it come Oscar time. And then people are going to use the fact that it's popular and that it's accessible, and they're going to reward the Coens for all the other stuff that was a little bit too esoteric. You know, they're going to get the major love that they probably should have got, in my mind, for No Country for Old Men. I mean, they were nominated for that, but they weren't rewarded. What did you think of the movie?
Well, it's kind of a sequel to No Country for Old Men in a way, right? So, yeah, totally worth seeing. Yes, it's Oscar worthy. The Coen brothers are kind of like hit or miss. This is clearly a hit. It's a great movie. I don't really know why they made it, right? Like, I'm not really sure, but it's good, you know? And I don't know if there's a lot to say about it, because it's really straightforward, but my three favorite things. So Matt Damon is amazing.
Fucking so good.
I love when he plays like the Sarah Silverman, you know? And he never gets credit for that, but it's so good, right? And he's obviously not going to get credit for this performance, but I love him in this movie.
He's the best thing in a great film.
Yeah, like, yeah.
In a field of great performances, he stands above.
Well, you mentioned 310 to Yuma, and my boy Doug Pepper as Outlaw Ned, you know, with the screwed up teeth, really reminded me of the villain in 310 to Yuma, and I had to go and look it up to make sure that they weren't the same person, and they're not, actually, but,
no,
you know.
No, Barry Pepper, right?
Oh. What's his name? But his name's,
His name in the film is Ned Pepper.
Is Ned Pepper. I screwed that up.
His name is Barry Pepper.
And so, you know, from the horse clerk through to Brolin through to Pepper, the casting in this for the tertiary characters, amazing, right? Yep. And then like, just, you know, Damon aside, the humor in this movie, like, I read some critics and they were like, oh yeah, the Coens are playing it straight and narrow. And I'm like, maybe. They play the racism for laughs, for Christ's sakes, right? Like, when...
That was weird.
So there's the hanging sequence, right, where there's laughs, and then when they kick the Indian children off the doctor steps.
Yes.
And to get away with that, whether or not they do or not, and you sound like you don't think that they do, but like, no, that takes a maturity that like Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't even have. And I was just like, oh, this is just as dark and twisted as every other Coen Brothers movie, but you wouldn't know it, right? And so I kind of applauded them for that. So anyway,
I thought it was as dark and maybe as complicated as other Coen Brothers films. I didn't think that it complicated its ideas nearly as much as their other films, which I kind of enjoyed about it. I just felt like, you know, they're fantastic craftsmen, they're fantastic storytellers, and so I kind of feel like they were going for entertainment in a way that they, or purely entertainment in a way that they haven't gone for it in other films. And I really appreciated that and enjoyed that, but they didn't complicate their ideas about violence, they didn't complicate their ideas about heroism, just in the way that they have in other films. I mean, I think that the worst thing that you can be in a Coen Brothers film is fearful, right? Like, just historically in their films, like, those are the characters. It doesn't matter where you fall on the moral scale. If you are bold, you will be rewarded in a Coen Brothers film. And so this was a film populated with bold characters, right? Even Damon, who is set up so that you don't quite know how to take him for a lot of the film, I think eventually, you know, comes down on the side of being a bold, decisive character. And so it was, on the one hand, great to see a movie populated with those kinds of characters. But on the other hand, I didn't feel like they were scratching that surface very much, which is why I think that the accidental comedy racism played a little bit weird for me. But it's such a minor note in an overall thing that I don't want to really dwell on it. It was interesting. Have you seen Winter's Bone?
No.
For those who don't know, Winter's Bone is this little indie film that came out this year, and it's out on DVD now, and it's directed by Deborah Granick and is based on a novel by Daniel Woodrell, and it's oddly parallel to True Grit in that it's set in the modern day, but set in the Ozarks. So it has, I guess, the setting of, you know, of the Western, and there's not very much modern about it. And it's about this 17-year-old girl, Ree Dolly, who is the daughter of a meth chemist, like a guy who runs meth labs for, you know, the local meth dealers. And he's gone missing, and he's supposed to come up for his trial, and he's posted their land as security against his bail bond. And now he's gone missing. And if he doesn't show up for trial, then they're going to lose everything. And her mother is there, but not there. She's, you know, mentally ill and just can't really care for the family. And so in the same way that Matty Ross in True Grit has to kind of step up and, you know, go on this manhunt and take care of her family, Ree in Winter's Bone is almost exactly the same story. You know, there is an older male character who joins her in this hunt. Like, it's remarkably, remarkably similar. And yet the tone could not be more the polar opposite. And after watching Winter's Bone, which was a fantastic film, and again, Jennifer Lawrence, who plays Ree, is just like Hailee Steinfeld in True Grit, both young actresses, both their first major role, both being talked about for Oscars either. And the debate really is just whether it'll be as best lead or best supporting actor. And True Grit felt almost lightweight in the light of Winter's Bone, which isn't to say that they're both not phenomenal films, but it really just pointed up how much of an entertainment was True Grit, how much of an entertainment True Grit was, as opposed to Winter's Bone, and then as opposed to the sort of the history of the Coens. Still, fantastic as an entertainment, though. Fantastically well done, and I just recommend it to everybody. I think this is the kind of film that whether you're 20 or 80, you're just going to love it.
Hailee Steinfeld is actually credited as a supporting actress in the credits.
And I feel like that's a political move because
it's weird because she's got like more screen time than anyone else.
Than anybody else, right? And actually one of the main differences between this adaptation of True Grit and the John Wayne adaptation is that they've refocused the film around her. I think that I haven't seen the original of True Grit with John Wayne, but I think what they did was that they lopped off the sort of the framing sequence where this is her remembrance as an older woman, and so it makes it more Rooster Cogburn's story than it does hers, whereas the Coens have reformulated it so that it's very much her story. And so, yeah, definitely, I don't think of her as a supporting actress in the film, although if that's, you know, what she has to do, what the studio has to do to get her a nomination, to get more eyeballs on the film, then, you know, fair play to them.
Okay, so here's my second question. Just finished Catching Fire, Suzanne Collins.
Okay.
What do you think of Hailee Steinfeld as Katniss?
Ooh. I think she could be great. She's a fantastic actress. She's the right age. Yeah, that could be interesting. Although Entertainment Weekly has been dribbling out these tiny little bits of a much longer interview that they did with Gary Ross, who's the director for Hunger Games. And they've talked a lot about going with an unknown, although they're not necessarily going to go with an unknown. But I think what we had in Hailee Steinfeld in this movie, just, you know, a complete unknown, a complete blank slate, that's what I want for Katniss. And so she can't do it twice,
right?
You know, but I want somebody of the, yeah, absolutely of the same timber as Hailee Steinfeld.
Because there's this whole thing with which kind of passed me by, but Katniss being non-white, right? Like she's described in the story as being olive colored.
Oh, okay.
And so with like, so I guess, you know, there's been some controversy around having a fair haired actress play her.
Right.
Not that, you know, you couldn't make up or you know, dye the hair of a Chloe Moretz or whatever, but
right.
Yeah. So fans were kind of annoyed. Now it's weird because she's described as like olive skin and dark and kind of swarthy.
Start again with she's described as
no. So but Prim, her sister is blonde and fair skinned. So it's never really clear. It's not really clear in the narrative if she's non-white or not. You know what I mean?
I don't think she's non-white. I think Rue is definitely black, right?
I don't know about Rue.
I think she is. So I didn't spend... I think that there are clues there in the narrative. If you want to break it down, I did not spend a lot of time because I think that the different districts have different ethnicities.
Right.
And so I think the clues are there if you want to break it down and figure out, you know, what the ethnic background is of the various districts.
So but, I've kind of got like an Evangeline Lilly as a younger Katniss, and like Gale is kind of a Patrick Swayze from like circa Red Dawn.
Right.
And in my mind's eye, I kind of had like the prim Rue like double character as kind of a preteen Dakota Fanning. So all of those things sound like they're pretty far off the mark, but of
Pretty far
course
from the
none of
right.
those ages work.
I think Rue is definitely not Dakota Fanning. But
Whatever.
regardless,
Okay, so this week.
it's all acting. But let's jump into High Rise.
Right. So I'm enthusiastic about. Do I sound enthusiastic? I'm enthusiastic about James Graham Ballard's High Rise. And High Rise takes place in like a 40-story condo building owned and inhabited by about 2,000 or so professionals. So, like doctors, accountants, filmmakers, etc. And it begins with like a scene on the 25th story of this condo building, and a doctor in his apartment observes like a champagne bottle hurtling down and smashing on his balcony, kind of like throwing from, you know, the floors above kind of thing. And so the doctor, you know, this is how the novel starts. The doctor's like, "What the fuck?" You know, but it's pretty clear after a few paragraphs that the condo tower is kind of like in a constant state of party. It's like party 24/7, 7 days a week, which is redundant, but whatever. The building is cast as like this kind of like stationary cruise liner. It's got all the amenities, and it's all about the good times, and it's all about the party. So what happens next is that these petty grievances, like the champagne bottle flying and smashing and like cracking his like linoleum tiling or whatever, begin to pile up, and those grievances are kind of compounded by the strain that having 2,000 people in this like mega complex brings on the building services. So the elevators go on the blitz, and then, you know, the garbage chute gets full, and then the tenants start getting chippy with one another. Then you meet on the first floor, there's like this filmmaker, and on the 40th floor, there's a tenant who's an architect. And from the perspective of the doctor on the 25th, the filmmaker on the first, and the architect on the 40th, you kind of get their perspective as kind of everything kind of like all goes to hell. So that's the story. That's
That's the story.
that's what it's
So
about.
now this book is from mid-70s?
1975.
Right. And have you read a lot of Ballard?
None.
So just this one.
So my.
Have you seen Crash, the Cronenberg film?
I have.
Right, that is my only experience of Ballard, which
Which.
probably is, it's more Cronenberg than Ballard, so it probably jades my impression of him.
Well, depends if you like Ballard. Depends if you like Cronenberg, I
Oh, I like
guess.
Cronenberg, but I don't know if that's an accurate representation of Ballard.
So that was a question I had too. So why, like, so first of all, why did I pick this book up? So I heard in the fall that Vincenzo Natali, who's a director from Montreal, is making a film of this book. And then, like, a couple weeks later, the 1977 cover kind of popped up in my Twitter feed, and so I was just like, weird. And then I was talking to my friend Dan, and I was just like, "Dan, I've never read Ballard before, and I was thinking High Rise might be a good place to start, you know, like it's just kind of come up with this Natali film announcement, all that." And he was just like, "I love that book, totally go for it, right?" So I
So
got it, I
this is a
liked
recent
it.
read.
What's that?
So this is a recent read. Like, this isn't something that you read back in the day that you've loved for years, right? This is fresh.
I read it last week.
Interesting.
So I bought it after Dan recommended it, and I read it, I got it, I liked it. I'm here to be enthusiastic about it, but as usual with my enthusiasms, there's caveats, right? So I'm not going to be putting this in just anyone's hands, you know, this isn't the True Grit of novels.
Right, okay.
And it's kind of a grown version of Lord of the Flies a bit, and I mean, you know, we've talked about Battle Royale and stuff like that, and so by grown up, I mean, like, not only involving adults, but it also has a fairly more sophisticated kind of critique of society than just kind of the, you know, the kind of nasty British and short thing that was going on in the Golding book, you know?
Right.
And so the characters basically mutiny, right? Like, so these tenants of this condo basically mutiny, but the challenging part of it, the really challenging part of it, is that they're the owners of the building, right? Like, it's a condo. So they're basically mutinying against themselves.
Right.
And so, like, there's no external threat, there's no zombies, there's no droogs, there's no white blindness epidemic, there's no, like, Children of Men-style biological threat. Like, the tenants are basically just going off on one another, like, on their own, right? Like,
mutiny at the co-op.
Yeah, like, prompted by nothing, really. But, you know, prompted by the elevators breaking down, which is, like, anyway. So, yeah, so, like, it becomes Lord of the Flies in this building. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the residents go off to work daily. And then they return it for, you know, they return after their day's work. There's, like, a condo tower across the street, and the tenants in that tower have no idea. Like, they're completely unaware. They, like, as bad as things get, and things get pretty bad, the tenants don't try and escape. And you know, they could call the cops, but they don't do that either. You know, like, the cops drive by, and the doctor on the 25th floor, like, watches the cop car, like, drive by the building and does nothing, you know?
So what's the tone? Is it comic? Is it satiric? Like,
it's perverse.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's not like an open critique. It ultimately is a fairly scathing critique, but it's complicated, right? Like, yeah, no, it's complicated. So, you know, it's like, what happens, you know, you take the idea, I think the idea that Ballard's chasing is like, okay, so what happens if you take, you know, you kind of veer to the edge of civilized society and then you, like, plunge over the edge and you bring everybody with you? What happens then? So, on one hand, like, speaking of tone, like, on one hand, I could totally see putting this in the hands of, like, a high school student and right. being like, whoa, this will blow your mind. Like, and then having that student go off and do, like, an amazing essay on kind of, like, the psychology of post-Empire England. Like, it's got that, like, Day of the Triffids or Trifids.
Triffids.
Do you ever read that in high school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wyndham, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that with, like, booze, drugs, and sex. Right?
Excellent.
So, in a way, it's like a great allegory and is told really simply, and you could, like, there's lots to kind of, like, put your claws into if you were, like, a grade 11 student doing an essay. On the other hand, it's like, man, you give this book to someone with, like, a kind of fragile sense of the world, and it's like, it's bleak going. It's bleak going there for a while. You know, it's only 177 pages, but, like, it gets pretty dark and pretty bleak in the middle. And, you know, it's just very unvarnished that way, right? So.
And what are the science fiction trappings of it? Are there? Because I know that that's largely what Ballard is known for, is as a science fiction writer, and yet it sounds like a lot of his writing, from what I know of his catalog, is not very sci-fi at all.
Right, right. So, yeah. So, I figured it was kind of like a great introduction to the like 70s dystopian Brit lit. Right. I haven't read Ian Banks either. Have you read him?
No.
Wasp Factory or whatever, but they kind of go together in my head for some reason.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wasp Factory's been sitting on my shelf for years. I've always meant to read it.
Yeah. So I was just like, okay, so I enjoyed the book, and then I put it down, and there were kind of two things that I kind of wanted to chase in Google after I finished it, and one was how science fiction-y was this in 1975? Because it definitely doesn't read as very science fiction-y. And then the other thing was, I was getting to your point off the top, which was like, how representative is this of his like other 30 or so novels, right? So looking around on Wikipedia, a 40-story high-rise with a shopping mall on the 10th floor, doesn't seem very futuristic to me now, or doesn't seem very futuristic in 1975. The World Trade Center would have went up, I guess, in, what, 73? The Towering Inferno, the Newman McQueen movie, would have came out in 74. So, like, high-rise building mania would have been, like, going on right around then.
Right.
But was not in the UK. So the tallest building in the UK in 1980 was 47 floors.
Huh.
Yeah. And because of code and all that stuff, right? But, like, you know, I'm thinking the Empire State Building is, like, whatever, 112 stories, I think.
Yeah.
And that's from the 20s. 1980, they did not have skyscrapers in England.
So this would have been more futuristic in the UK than in the US.
A little, yeah. So it's, like, futury in that, like, zero history futury kind of way, right? It's really an alternate 1975.
Right.
Like, it's really just a contemporary novel that, you know, it's just got, like, fantastic elements to it. And it's, you know, the science is really psychiatric, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, so... You know, what I knew about Ballard, I'd seen Crash with the Cronenberg movie. I knew that he got stolen, like, motherfucker, from the bookstore when we worked there, right?
Right.
So someone liked him. He was popular. He got stolen a lot. But
all those fucking kids who wanted to write those mind-blowing papers.
But then there's The Empire of the Sun, right? The Spielberg movie?
Right, which is his memoir, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I was just like, okay, so you've got, like, Spielberg, Empire of the Sun on one side, and then you have Cronenberg, Crash on the other. What's the deal, right? Like, where does he net out? And have you seen Empire of the Sun?
I think so. Long time gone.
I haven't, right? So it says on the internet, like, he was born in Shanghai, I guess, and then interred in a Japanese prison camp when he was a teenager. Like, for real? So I guess, like, a lot of his fiction has got this preoccupation with kind of what happens when, kind of, like, society kind of, like, you know, cultures go manic on other cultures kind of thing. And, you know, it's like he's basically a documentarian of kind of societal trauma.
Right.
And that kind of fits
in.
Yeah, that kind of fits in with both the psychiatric elements and the high-rise part. And then, like, technology's introduced and whatever, right? So I, from what I can gather from reading, high-rise is a representative work, but not, like, a seminal one. Like, it's not one that it's, right, like, second tier, but still, you know, has all these.
But it sounds like his seminal works are a bit more all over the map, right? Because he's got Empire of the Sun, which is his memoir. And then doesn't he have a trilogy, which is not science fiction at all, and takes the perversity to like a next level. That's what I think. That's what I seem to remember hearing about Ballard. We should chuck that into the show notes.
Yeah,
but I think he goes the other way when he doesn't have the science fiction.
Right.
Right. Like it's all the science fiction is almost a controlling element in his work, and without that, you know, it really gets hardcore.
Right. And so it's not porny. It's not like Henry Miller, where it's just like, oh, I'm gonna write about sex, and it's like, boing chicka boing boing. It's not that. It's more like, you know, people are.
It's the 70s.
Well, it's a weird kind of cant on nihilism, right? And it's just like, what happens if you take nihilism to its logical conclusion? And anyway, so.
Okay, so you said there was. Two people that you would, or two groups of people that you would recommend this to, right? There's the high school student.
Well, I said I wouldn't recommend it to kind of like the fragile minded.
Right.
So, right. Yeah. So I'm not gonna like, unless I'm tipped off that someone's like, it reminded, you know, who would really like it actually is fans of Philip K. Dick.
Right.
So, but fans of Philip K. Dick probably know that they already, like, that's probably not news. Right?
Right.
And it's like, do you know that French writer, Michel Houellebecq?
No.
He wrote, Atomized a couple years ago. Anyway, it's like Michel Houellebecq meets PKD. That's who I'm just like, if people are in either of those camps, then this is perfect kind of thing. But it's not as like, it's not as deep. It's not like deep weird like those are. Anyway. It reminded me a little bit of Blindness, Saramago, right? Because that's a story about society all going to hell, right? And you know, if people found that difficult to read in places, then obviously this wouldn't be for them either.
Right.
So, anyway, that's my pick for the week.
I think, you know, I think I'm sold. I think actually, oddly enough, out of all of that, I think you sold me with the Gibson reference, because I'm kind of interested to see what very short-term futurism looks like 35 years later. I think that's kind of interesting, and it just sounds like the general ideas and the general plot are interesting as well. So I think I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's awesome. And it's only 177 pages. Did I mention that?
Yes, you did.
So
not a huge commitment.
Yeah. And there's a particular like British element to it, right? And so one of the things that happens in this building is they degenerate to kind of like stereotypical class structure fairly immediately. So like there's like an upper class and a lower class that develops in this building. Upstairs, downstairs.
Excellent.
So, anyway.
All right. Well, that's it for another episode. Now that you've heard what we're into this week, we'd love to hear what you're enthusiastic about. You can drop us an email at hello@enthusiasticast.com or visit us at our website, enthusiasticast.com, and leave a comment in the show notes. Until next week, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.